Area Voices tells the arts, culture, and history stories of northern Minnesota. And this morning I'll be talking with Kent Nerburn. Kent's book, Neither Wolf Nor Dog, was a 1996 Minnesota Book Award winner. And in the book, Kent brings the reader deep into the world of the Sioux Indians in South Dakota, as he is called to tell the story of an elder named Dan. And the book was made into a film and released back in 2016. And this week, Kent has been in Grand Rapids, where he's showed the film last night to the public and yesterday to a group of high school students. And it will also be shown again tonight at 6:30 at the Chucker Auditorium at the Itasca Community College in Grand Rapids. And Kent's with us now. Good morning, Kent.
Good morning, Katie.
Good to hear your voice. So let's dial it back a little bit. What prompted you initially to get involved with Native American issues, and why have you kind of committed yourself to making that part of your life's work as a writer?
Well, I'm happy to answer and will, but I want to dial it back even further.
For those of you
out there who are, in some ways, I can't see my audience, obviously, but there's got to be a lot of people I know there. For those of you that don't know, I spent 25 years living in Bemidji. And Katie and I go back a long way. Katie is actually the godmother to my dog, Lucy. We were actually going to have a sort of a co-ownership, but she went rogue and got a different dog. So, and she also was the undertaker that had to bury my cats.
That's true. We do have a long history.
A long history, a long and checkered history. But anyway, so, you know, how did I get involved with Native issues, and why do I stay with them as a writer? Mm-hmm. Well, it was actually a very interesting accident that when we moved to Bemidji, it was 30 years ago now, I was working primarily as a sculptor. And making a living as a sculptor was both incredibly difficult, and it was the sort of psychic reality of the area wasn't good for sculpture. It doesn't have the natural forms. It doesn't inspire you in the same way that it inspires you as, say, a painter or a writer. And also, you can't make a living as a sculptor. Well, you can hardly make a living in northern Minnesota anyway, but we all do what we can. But I came across this chance to work on the Red Lake Reservation because they had a job for someone to teach history. It was taking over for Bob Troyer, you know, one of the great men in my life, Tony and David's dad. And they wanted someone to teach history. And I said, well, you know, I can't teach history, but I love what I understood about the Native people. And I proposed to them that they let me do an oral history project, kind of like the Foxfire books. And they agreed. And so I went up and spent a couple of years working on the reservation, collecting the stories of the elders, taking the students out, went into the community and interviewing the elders, and we put together a couple of books. And so in those 2 years or 3 years that I worked there, I really came to discover two things. And the first one was how incredibly misrepresented the Native experience had been in our American historical narrative. And secondly, that the Native people had so much to teach us all about the way to live, basic values that are inherent in Native culture. And you know, those of us on the outside may not always see them. The valuation of the elders, the larger understanding of family, the belief that there is a spiritual dimension to life that has to be acknowledged at all points. And it just goes on and on. I said, you know, I can do something with this. I've got skills as a writer. I'd done it for many years prior to that. And I said, when I left the reservation, I said, I want to use these skills to give back for what it was that I'd been given. I loved my time on Red Lake. I loved my time when I would work out and since then and working in the Dakotas and working with the Nez Perce, and really took it on as using the skills that I have to try to bring the Native experience and Native values into the general public discourse. Mm-hmm. And the books and the film are sort of one way of doing that.
Yeah, so they're autobiographical.
They're autobiographical in that they're real people, real events, real places put together into teaching stories. I remember being told when I used to take the students out to interview the elders, one of the men whose name I won't mention said to me, you should always teach by stories because stories lodge deep in the heart. And we know how important story is to the native peoples, all the native peoples, as a way of teaching. And so I said, I'm going to write teaching stories, and I'm going to use my own experience, my own people, and my own, and the places I've been to tell these stories. Because, we don't think about it here in northern Minnesota, but you get outside of our area where the land still speaks of the native experience, and the native experience is on the surface, and culturally we all interact. You get out into the big cities, you get out of the general area where there's a strong native presence, people don't have a clue. The native experience is reduced to another minority group, and instead of being seen as the elder cultures of this land, they're seen as just one more marginalized minority group and get misrepresented. It just felt to me like I needed to use my experience, because if you write from your own experience, you bring something very much alive. Mm-hmm. So that was what I decided to do, just write from my own experience and tell the stories that I thought needed to be told.
Yeah. And now your stories have gone to the big screen, which kind of opens up a whole new sort of audience that maybe a non-reading audience.
Well, it was a very interesting experience. The man that made the film, first of all, we're not talking a big Hollywood production. What happened was, my dirty little secret as a writer is that I'm a sub-vocalizer. I read very slowly. I can pretty much switch from reading in my head to speaking out loud at what I'm reading. So because of that, I tend to see, I pay a lot of attention to detail and to rhythm and language. And also as a sculptor and in the arts, I tend to think visually and in terms of the senses. So when I got done with Neither Wolf Nor Dog, people said, oh, it's got to be a movie. It should be made into a movie. And fine, I love it. It sounds like a great idea, but how do you go about doing something like that? Well, long story short, a Hollywood director, a pretty high-quality guy, found the book when he was doing a really wretched film on Crazy Horse for HBO out in South Dakota and contacted me. That was when I was still living here in northern Minnesota, and said, I'd like to talk to you about making that book into a film. Hey, sounds great. So anyway, I had to go out. I was going in out to do some speaking anyway, and the publisher sent me to talk to this man, John Irvin. And he loved the idea, and we worked. Actually, for a couple of years, he had me working on the screenplay with him. He gave me a real crash course in how to stop thinking like a writer and start thinking like a screenwriter. And it's a very different modality, very different way of understanding. But he couldn't get the film made. No one could get it made. And finally, at one point, my son Nick, who good schoolcraft and a graduate and a lover of Bemidji, who's now making films here in the North Country, came to me and said, Dad, you can't get it together. You're never going to get that thing made. You're going to die, and I'm going to have to make that film. I said, come on, Nick, that's not going to happen. I'm going to figure this out. So I sent out sort of an all-points bulletin to people that had shown interest in the film in the past, and the idea. And there was a man that I had met when I was out in Pine Ridge who was showing a film that he had made on the res out there. And his name was Stephen Simpson. He was a Scotsman. And so Stephen and I were staying in the same 30-buck-a-night motel. And we got talking, and I gave him a copy of Neither Wolf Nor Dog. I had given him a copy of Neither Wolf Nor Dog, and that was years before this, and Nick threw it on the gauntlet. And so he and I hadn't talked about it. When I sent out this all-points bulletin, he got back to me and said, yeah, okay, I'd be willing to make it, but you have to understand if I say I'm going to make it, I'm going to make it on my own terms. And he did. He made it for a budget of like $60,000 that mostly was raised by a Kickstarter campaign. He's a difficult man to work with. He was irascible, and like a lot of people who are single-minded, you know, you get out of his way. And we worked together to put together this film, and he's been distributing it as a sort of a self-distributed system. It's a really complex system, but he isn't working through the major theatrical networks. And he gets it into a lot of small theaters. And one of the places he started was in Bemidji. And so this was the film has had a long, it's been a couple of years now. It's shown in over 100 cities, a lot of small towns in America. And it's a good film. A film is a different thing from a book. I remember John Irvin, when we were first talking about screenwriting, said to me that a book is like getting in a canoe and traveling around a lake. You can stop on an island. You can go into a bay. You can spend as much time as you want. A film is like getting in a boat on a river with a strong current. You get in and you start and you don't stop and you go to the end. So you throw away so much of a book to do a film, but what you get instead is a visual presence, and mm-hmm. it brings in a different audience. There are a lot of people that aren't going to bother reading a book, mm-hmm. but they'll go see a film. And I think that Stephen did a really good job of cutting a fine line down the center of the film, primarily based around the characters, and the main one being Dave Bald Eagle, a Lakota elder who played Dan. And, you know, he just owns the screen. The guy is just, he's magical. And he was 95 when he did the film. So anyway, you know, we sort of got, you know, it was a blind pig and an acorn, but we got a pretty good acorn out of that. And I'm real proud of that. I'm happy to show it.
Yeah. And for me, growing up in South Dakota, when I went to the film at the theater, I felt like I was right there riding horse next to my sister on the plains of South Dakota. It really was right there.
It captures, I think it's got res dust on it, and I think it captures the plains. Because, I mean, I'm one of those people, you know, like you, Katie. I mean, you're a South Dakota girl, but I was a Twin Cities boy. But when I got up here, I always thought, well, now that we're moving to northern Minnesota, boy, I'm going off into the boundary waters. I'm going to be going canoeing. It's going to be loons and canoes and, you know, and promontories of pine trees. Mm-hmm. Nope. I got fascinated with the Dakotas. I love the Dakotas. I love what they bring to you, the singularity of the experience, the way that it's very meditative. And so I'm a great advocate of the Dakotas, and you know, and the film catches that. And in fact, that was one of the really neat things that this year, you know, this book is, geez, how old now? The book on which the film is based, Night of Wolf, Their Dog, was done in, 96? Mm-hmm. It won the Minnesota Book Award. Well, this year, South Dakota chose it as the one book South Dakota reads by the Humanities Commission. So all the small towns and all the communities, well, like any of those one book programs, it's for the whole state of South Dakota, because I think they recognize that it catches the pulse of the land. At the same time, it speaks to some of the real cultural issues that the plains have, of the native presence still being strong, and yet the movement of other European cultures onto them, and how that interaction takes place.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's definitely it's a book of the outdoors, and it's a book of the plains and the prairies.
Yeah, and the relationship between natives and whites and the history of all that. What do you think, so in South Dakota, all kinds of youth will be reading that book, and I know that you talked mm-hmm. to some high school kids yesterday in Grand Rapids about mm-hmm. the movie, and maybe they read the book before they saw the movie. I don't know what their teacher had them do, but what was their reaction? What did you take away from that conversation with those kids?
Well, they were, the class was separate from the showing of the film, and so I haven't talked to them after the showing of the film scene, and I don't even know how many of them went. But I mean, what I try to do when I talk to young people now is I recognize that I've got a different responsibility, and that I was in a sweat lodge in Pine Ridge. I was given the chance to be in one on my 60th birthday, and I remember having, you know, when it comes time for you to sort of pray and ask for, you know, bury your heart, and I said that I want to learn how to be an elder. I don't want to be a senior citizen. I don't want to be this some vestigial old crab. that, you know, complaining about the young people. I need to think in the way that the Native people have taught me, that life is seasons and not a straight line from birth to death. And the one who gets, only the ones who get to the last seasons of life have seen everything and speak with some authority about what it is that that those who are coming up behind are going to face. So when I talk to the kids, I try to tell them, I try to show them that you can continue to speak from the heart. You don't have to become hard-edged and cynical, and that you have to try to see the world through different sets of eyes. Mm-hmm. And instead of looking for a right and a wrong, and God knows we're living in a strange time politically right now, where it's all it's controversy, and it's looking for the winners and the losers. And I try to tell the kids that, you know, I try to explain to them that there are multiple points of view. And in the film and in the book and in all my books, I try to show that there are different paradigms of understanding the world. One isn't right over others, but we all can learn from each other. They're all like different instruments in some great symphony of creation. And, you know, the kids responded well. The woman sent me their responses. She has a little two-minute write at the end of the class, 2 minutes where they sit and write. And they all enjoyed it, you know. And I talked, you know. I got a bad case of white man's disease. You know, you put a nickel in, I'm going to talk to them. Well, witness what I'm doing right now. And but I talked a lot, and I thought, God, am I just going on like a windbag? But apparently, I connected with them, you know.
Good.
And I try to be authentic. That's what I, you know. They need to see a way that they can age. See, you have to try to model some kind of behavior, that there's a way to get older and use that to be reflective and to empower other people, not merely to get, you know, to close in around your own point of view. So anyway, it was very successful, and the showing of the film, the people that were there, it's fun to show it in northern Minnesota, because a lot of the humor, it's fun to hear where laughter comes in.
Yeah.
A film that has a certain amount of humor. And the northern Minnesotans, especially the natives that were there, you know, they understand. And the things that I knew were humorous, they would catch.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, all in all, it was just a wonderful experience. I'm looking forward to the next couple of showings.
Yeah, it's going to be tonight at 6:30 at the Chucker. When you were just talking about the high school kids and, I don't know, just kind of helping them to see with different glasses, look at the world through different perspectives, it reminded me of, there's a saying by Rumi, it's something like, out beyond the lands of wrongdoing and right-doing, there's a field. I'll meet you there.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, you know, that's exactly the kind of reflective wisdom of Rumi, is the kind of thing you try to grow into as you get older. I mean, you know, men have a different set of challenges than women do in terms of how to age gracefully and to turn around and give back. But that's it. You want to find that field where we can meet together and where you can say to the younger people, you know, this field is out there. You know, you're not just going to go off the end of a cliff and disappear. This field is out there where we can meet. And if I can turn around and give something back, hey, that's, you know, that's paying my rent on earth. That's what I got to do.
That's right. That's Kent Nerburn. He'll be at the Chucker Auditorium tonight, 6:30 p.m. at the Itasca Community College. Thank you so much, Kent.
Hey, thanks, Katie. And if you're coming over at UNF, looking forward to seeing you.
Yay. Okay, we'll see you later.
I'll show you pictures of Lucy, our co-dog.
Great.
See you then. All right.
Bye.
Right. Bye-bye.
Erie Voices is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and by the people of Minnesota.